We're learning about an invasive earthworm introduced from Eastern Asia called crazy worms or jumping worms here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. Scientists say these unusual worms are a danger to our forests, our animals, and plants. And over the years, they've spread to more than a dozen states, including here in Wisconsin. Have you come across a so-called crazy worm? Where did you see it? What did you observe? What do you want to know about these worms? It's 800-642-1234. Brad Herrick is an ecologist and research program manager at the UW-Madison Arboretum. Brad, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with a visual in our mind's eye, if you will. What do these worms look like?
So to the, I guess, the untrained eye, they look just like every other earthworm, you know, similar to the night crawler that we're used to for fishing. But they're, where they're invaded, they are much, much more abundant. And since they really only live in the top few centimeters of soil, they're much more apparent because you just see them much more often. But generally, they're just kind of a brownish red worm. As adults, though, the biggest difference is that they have this white ring near their head. It's called the clitellum, and it's where they produce these cocoons, their offspring. And when I give talks to master gardeners, other folks, I always emphasize this white ring because that's by far the easiest way to identify them.
That's their defining feature, yeah. What about their movements and behavior? Do they actually jump?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's the other thing that we talk about, too, is they are called jumping worms commonly for a reason. And they don't, you know, they don't have legs, so they're not jumping like you and I might think of jumping, but they thrash around quite a bit. And they can, you know, they have more of a rigid body than other earthworms. And so because of that anatomy, they can lift themselves off the ground just by flopping around and thrashing. And so it appears that they are jumping, but they're not, they don't have legs. They're not, you know, actually jumping. But the other behavior is that they act like a snake sometimes. So they're also called snake worms.
Mm-hmm.
And they do this S, kind of like snakes do to get away from predators. They just make the S shape as they're scooting away. So, and some of them are really long. And so I've had folks thinking that they have these new weird snakes in their garden when they're just these new creepy earthworms.
So they can actually get bigger than we would imagine our typical earthworm. You know, I saw this video of you holding one, and as you touched it, it would jump. And I wonder, does it respond to touch?
Yeah, right. So we don't know a lot about sort of the reasons for that behavior, other than it's likely has to do with disturbance or getting away from predators. So, right, if you unearth one, so to speak, it may not exhibit that jumping or snake behavior until you touch it and kind of, you know, not to anthropomorphize earthworms, but annoy it a little bit.
Hmm.
And then that's when it'll likely exhibit that thrashing behavior or snaking behavior. That's when you would most likely see it, when it gets disturbed.
And Brad, give us some historical reference here on where they came from and when they arrived here in Wisconsin.
Right. So depending on the, and there's many species of jumping worms. In fact, there's hundreds of different species. And in North America, we have about 17 different species. And they're generally from Southeastern Asia, China, the Korean Peninsula, and Japan. And interestingly enough, there's been records of a couple species of jumping worms in the lower 48 back to the turn of the 20th century.
Maine said they found one in a greenhouse in 1899.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah. So some of them are not necessarily new, quote unquote, invaders or, you know, earthworms to the continent. However, for whatever reason, those early invasions or those early introductions did not become invasive. They did not spread. And, you know, they've been down in the southeast part of the country as well. Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, for decades. And for whatever reason, though, the last 15 years or so, 20 years, they've really started to move. They've moved up the eastern seaboard, now to the Midwest. And we actually have records of them being in about 37 states now.
Wow.
And you know, we don't know why all of a sudden there was some threshold, some trigger that really, you know, expanded their range. You know, it's potentially some climate change happening, or just, you know, densely populated areas and moving of materials that have these jumping worms in them, or their cocoons just happened, and they've taken advantage of it.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with ecologist Brad Herrick of UW-Madison's Arboretum about these jumping worms, and he assists in developing long-term restoration plans for Arboretum lands. You can join in. Do you have jumping worms in your area or in your backyard? What would you like to know about them? What have you observed? 800-642-1234. Brad, getting into the ecology here, what threat do these worms have on Wisconsin forests?
Right. So we're just sort of you know, touching the surface now of the potential impacts of this new invasive species, yet another invasive species to Wisconsin. And, you know, what we know kind of so far is that they drastically change the soil. So in terms of the soil chemistry, how nutrients such as nitrogen and phosphorus that are really important for plant growth, they change the availability of those nutrients, often reducing them in the soil. And they change the structure of the soil. So this is another key way to tell if you have jumping worms or not. In your yard or in a forest, without actually seeing the worms, because they leave in their wake what we think is a permanent structural change in the soil. It looks like coffee grounds, or I've heard it described as taco meat, which is, I think, a less appealing way to think about it. But very granular, just little beads of soil that, from what we can tell, do not hold moisture as well. Is highly erodible and are high in nutrients, but those nutrients are tied up in these little beads of soil and are not able to get down to the root zone. And so that's one of the biggest changes that we're seeing. And, you know, we don't know, because this is a relatively new invasion, we still don't know what the long-term impacts of just the soil changes might be to plant growth, to amphibians that are using the soil, to other soil arthropods. And so that's still out there. We haven't seen any drastic changes to the plant community, although there is some indication. It's a different story in gardens. I'm hearing lots of stories about garden plants, whether they're ornamentals or natives, struggling. A lot of the impacts to forests are still unknown.
Lots of question marks.
Soil structure changes. Yeah.
Well, let's take a call. Patty is joining us in Sheboygan. Hi, Patty.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. We live on 8 acres of a wooded property, and some of the acreage does have stunts. I do have ornamental flowers. I did notice jumping worms in my beds. Is it true if you slice them in half with a shovel that you'll now have two growing? And then my second question is, if I pour like an ammonia or a vinegar in the soil, will that help kill the egg?
Patty, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Patty. Good question. So I get this first question a lot. If you slice an earthworm in half, do you now have two earthworms? And the answer is absolutely not. That will probably kill the earthworm, although they can survive with just being a shorter earthworm as long as their clitellum, that reproductive area, is still intact. So you are not creating two earthworms. Don't worry about that. And then the other question about pouring vinegar or an ammonia product into your soil. Folks are trying that. I don't know much about the ammonia application, but I have heard that a vinegar and water solution will definitely, on contact at least, will definitely kill the earthworms.
In what proportion, approximately?
Yeah, it's going to be a pretty low rate. You don't need much. Now, a caveat there is that we do not know the impacts of doing this kind of work on plants, on soil pH. They likely have other impacts that we don't know yet. And so I just kind of caution people to maybe try it in an area and just see what kind of impact they're seeing in terms of plant health. It will not affect cocoons, though. That's the problem with a lot of these applications, is that these cocoons have a hard shell, and we have not found anything as of yet that can penetrate that shell. But there is work that will be starting up hopefully pretty soon on looking at that part of their life cycle.
Yeah, we're going to look more at their reproduction with Brad Herrick, who's explaining crazy worms or jumping worms. He is a UW-Madison arboretum ecologist. Do you have jumping worms in your area? What would you like to know about them? Have you had a problem with these worms? What did they do to your soil? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Brad Herrick here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show as we discuss the effects of crazy worms. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Researchers have been studying what these invasive worms will do to the health of our forests and how to control established populations. Gardeners, what are your observations of these worms and what have you done to control them? According to the state of Maine's horticulture program, crazy worms are native to Korea and Japan and are now found from Maine to South Carolina and westward to our state. What is your experience with them? Have you come across them sold as fishing bait? Join in 800-642-1234. We have ecologist Brad Herrick, who is research manager at the UW-Madison Arboretum, with us for about 9 more minutes. So, Brad, can you explain their life cycle and how they reproduce?
Yes, definitely. And this is one way that we can separate them from all other earthworms that we might see in our environment. They have an annual life cycle. And so in the spring, they hatch from these little 2-millimeter cocoons that look just like soil. So they're very hard to see in the soil. They will hatch in those cocoons. And in about 2 months or so, they become mature. And so by mid-summer, you're going to start right about now. You're going to start to see a lot of these mature earthworms, and then they will, as far as we know, just kind of periodically produce cocoons. Mm-hmm. And until the first hard freeze, usually in our part of the state, sometime in mid-October. Once that happens, then the adult worms, all the earthworms, will die. But those cocoons will survive our winter, and they'll overwinter until the next spring where they'll hatch again. And so it is a true annual life cycle, which is pretty remarkable for this this invasive species that, you know, there are no alive earthworms for a bulk of the year, but yet they can still spread and be quite abundant during the summer.
Yeah, so they have like these winter tents that hold them over.
That's right. Yeah. It's pretty remarkable. And, you know, they can produce many cocoons each individually. And if you have a high abundance of earthworms, you have a lot of cocoons. And it's very different than other earthworms that are able to dig into the soil below the frost line and survive. And so that's one of the reasons why we talk about that a lot, is because if people see large earthworms in like April or May, those are very unlikely to be jumping worms because they haven't matured yet. And so those are going to be some other type of earthworms at that point of year.
Well, you know, Brad, there are so many different invasive plants and animals out there that invade our natural habitat in, you know, countless ways. Where do crazy worms fall in the continuum of least concerning to most concerning invasive?
Well, I'm probably biased here, but I think they're up near the top at this point. And they're still somewhat unknown, surprisingly. But the reason why they're still unknown, it's likely because they're pretty cryptic, right? They're earthworms, and so you don't you may not see them in the soil if you're just walking through the forest, like you would buckthorn or a stand of ash trees that's been attacked by emerald ash borer, garlic mustard is very obvious, but the damage that they can do to the soil and how quickly they are moving throughout the U.S. and into Canada, I think really puts them near the top of these new invaders. Mm. And the fact that they are spreading faster, and there's more questions from the public than we have answers to. So that's what makes them even particularly more, scary, is that we don't know what the long-term effects are. We don't know a lot of these basic biology questions. Because, this is a new invasive, and so we're trying to get up to speed with answers.
Well, researchers also think perhaps that these worms threaten sugar maple trees. And in Wisconsin, of course, we produce hundreds of thousands of gallons of maple syrup a year. Are you concerned these worms could affect maple syrup output?
Absolutely. Yeah. Sugar maple is a very common tree, not only in Wisconsin, but throughout the upper Midwest and New England. Maple syrup, as well as, just hardwood, other uses for maple wood. That's definitely a concern. And there are some studies going on in Vermont and other places looking at potential, how they affect sugar maple establishment. Mm-hmm. And how do they affect just their growth and health, and trickling down to the more commodity, the sugar maple or the maple syrup manufacturing. And so that's definitely one of the sort of biggest concerns that we have, is just with that resource, which affects a big part of the economy.
We're talking with ecologist Brad Herrick of UW-Madison's Arboretum, explaining the effects of non-native jumping worms in Wisconsin, the spread of these worms in North America. Do you have jumping worms? Have you ever seen one? What have been the effects to your soil, to your garden, to your landscape? 800-642-1234. Brad, at this point in trying to tackle the biology and start answering a lot of these questions, how important is the citizen science, the observations at this point?
They are critical, to be honest. They're spreading at such a rate that, scientists alone or even graduate students cannot, track them fast enough and learn enough at large scales. And so community science, citizen science is absolutely critical. And that's a good segue maybe into a project that I wanted to plug, and that is we have a new project that just started. It's a jumping worm survey and outreach project that is funded through a Baldwin grant through campus. And the idea with this is to engage the gardening community in Wisconsin to tell us just simply, what are you observing in your backyard garden, in your community garden? And so we're looking for participants to help just to do a survey and maybe a follow-up focus group, so that we can kind of, as a community, create a network and share our observations. And the end result of this project is hopefully to create a list of plants that, may have some resilience to jumping worm effects, and maybe a list of plants that we know are really impacted. Whether it's plant families or plant traits that gardeners should avoid in their landscaping or in their vegetable growing. And so, if there's folks listening that are interested in being part of this, if you go to our website, arboretum.wisc.edu, right front and center is a picture of a jumping worm, and you can click on that, and it'll take you to a link to sign up for that survey when it comes out.
Yeah, we also have that link at wpr.org/mornings. Let's bring in John in Glendale. John, hi.
Hi, good morning. I was wondering if these worms are a problem in their native lands, and if so, how they control them.
Yeah, that's a great question, John, and I get that one a lot too. And so with just like other invasive species, where every species is native to somewhere, and in their native.
How do I
say goodbye? You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about an iconic and prolific director.
The movies of Michael Schultz, like Coolie High, Car Wash, and Crush Groove, have given joy, drama, and great jams to millions around the world. The Milwaukee native was one of the first and most successful directors in Hollywood to bring the lives of Black Americans to the forefront of his films. Andy Turner recently talked to Schultz, who's now 83 years old, about his Milwaukee roots and long career, which continues today.
Michael Schultz has been around long enough that he gave Samuel L. Jackson and Denzel Washington their film debuts.
Hey, this gas fumes in here.
That means the engine's still running.
He's directed dozens of movies and television shows over the years, from Rockford Files and Starsky and Hutch to Heart of Dixie and New Girl. He was recently behind the camera, directing All American and Black Lightning on the CW. But according to Schultz, growing up on Vine Street in Milwaukee in the 40s and 50s, he never dreamed of making it to Hollywood. He remembers a meager existence, without refrigerators or supermarkets, spending lots of time with his grandmother while his single mother worked several jobs. A taste of country life existed in Milwaukee at the time, Schultz says, citing his grandmother's raising chickens in their yard as an example.
It wasn't in a cellophane package, all neatly cut up. You saw the chicken with his head chopped off and the thing running around, you know, and it was like almost like being on a farm in the city.
As a young boy and teenager, Schultz was an eager learner, which helped him later as a director, he says. He earned his Eagle Scout Award. He attended Riverside High School, where he played football and baseball and participated in theater productions.
I've learned a lot growing up of how to do a little bit of everything.
Schultz says his mother introduced him to opera, theater, and ballet. However, it was in the Catholic Church where Schultz began to truly understand the power of theater.
These high cathedral, you know, vaulted ceilings and the incense and the organ music and the choir singing and the priest up in front of the podium.
His love of movies comes from Saturday afternoon cliffhangers featuring Roy Rogers, Dale Evans, and Flash Gordon. They offered him his first taste of what he calls cinema energy.
It was almost like these serials you would see every weekend, where the hero would be in danger at the end of the episode, and you had to come back next week and see if he came out alive.
Despite those artistic influences and alluring drama, Schultz first pursued his dream of being a jet pilot or astronaut when he headed to the University of Wisconsin-Madison. After struggling with school, Schultz began to reconsider his career options. He found himself in Madison's movie theaters, watching foreign films and saying to himself, I wish I could do that.
So I'm watching movies by Fellini and Zeffirelli and Lelouch and Kurosawa and sitting in the back of the theater saying, man, these are great storytellers and great filmmaking. Way more interesting than Hollywood, you know?
He dropped out of college and went to work in a steel mill. But with the threat of being drafted into the Vietnam War looming, Schultz decided to go back to college full-time and subsequently enrolled in the theater program at Marquette University.
They didn't have a directing program, but in order to be in the theater, you had to do everything. You had to go to ballet class. You had to go to voice class. You had to go to acting class. You had to build sets or design lights or make costumes or whatever.
After graduating, he found success in New York's theater and television scenes. He eventually moved to Hollywood with hopes that his experience would get him on a big movie set. Coolie High showcases the lives and growing pains of Black Chicago teenagers in the early 1960s.
Come on. Get up, get up! Get out the bed, brother creature. We're going to be late for school.
It's Friday morning. School time. You dig?
The landmark movie with the iconic Motown soundtrack continues to resonate today.
It was showing kids, Black kids, as human beings, you know? And it was funny. It was all the things that growing up that you kind of go through. whether you're black or white.
Schultz says he didn't realize at the time the movie would have such a lasting impact, but he knew it would touch people. 1976's hilarious and funky Car Wash was Schultz's first of several movies with Richard Pryor. Schultz says he had a good working relationship with Pryor because they each respected each other. Pryor never did the same take twice, Schultz says, but he would do it five different ways and each would be hilarious.
And there's a good place in this world for money.
Yes, sir.
And I know where it is. It's right here in my pocket. Hey,
but what made him so accessible to everybody was his vulnerability. But people thought he was crazy and he was just super sensitive.
Music is always at the forefront of many of Schultz's movies, including Coolie High, Car Wash, and the polarizing Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band movie, starring Peter Frampton and the Bee Gees.
I get by with a little help from my friends. I get high with a little help from my friends. Yeah.
Music was also a big part of 1985's Crush Groove and The Last Dragon.
Who's badder than the Shogun?
Bruce Leroy, that too.
Bruce Leroy.
Schultz was inducted to the Black Filmmakers Hall of Fame in 1991 and has 113 directing credits to his name. Hollywood has a way of putting people in boxes, Schultz says, and after Coolie High, he was in the black comedy box. He says he fought his whole career not to be limited to that box and to do things his own way, to avoid the sausage factory approach to entertainment making.
And then there's a whole other kind of media making that is about something. It's about telling stories that impact the broader cultural conscience, that make a difference in how you see the world or how you see your fellow man, that make a difference in how you live your life.
Schultz continues to love to inspire and entertain, to make a difference through storytelling, and has no intention of stopping anytime soon.
People ask me, when are you going to retire? And I said, retire from fun? Are you kidding?
Andy Turner is a freelance journalist who lives in Milwaukee. He talked with the prolific director, Michael Schultz. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Maureen McCollum.
How do I say goodbye to what we had?
And just ahead, the FDA announced plans last year for a revised definition on the term healthy and when that claim can be made on food product labels. The FDA has also been researching a healthy symbol for packaging. Your thoughts on food labels as you compare them in the grocery aisle, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the IDS Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now to the meaning of the word healthy. Food labeling is regulated by the FDA. The Food and Drug Administration is testing designs of a label that food manufacturers could voluntarily put on their packages, indicating that a product is, quote, healthy. So join in on how you read food labels, 800-642-1234. Anna Grumman is a postdoctoral fellow in the Department of Nutrition at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Anna, welcome to the IDEAS Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. So there is this tension in the food labeling area over one word, and that is healthy. What is going on now with food makers and the FDA?
Yes. So as you mentioned, the FDA is doing two things right now. The first is around the definition of the word healthy. So as you mentioned, manufacturers are allowed to market their products using that word, for example, putting it on the front of the product's package. And the FDA has certain criteria that have to be met for companies to be allowed to use that word in their marketing. And the current definition is from the mid-90s, and they're working right now to update that definition to reflect the most recent science about healthy eating. The second thing that the FDA is doing is developing a new label that companies could choose to display if they want on their product's packaging when they meet that updated definition of healthfulness. And the goals of that label are to help consumers identify healthier foods more quickly and to promote healthier eating. So both about education and about behavior change. And that new label, again, would appear on the front of product packaging. And the FDA is conducting research to understand how to design that label to maximize these benefits.
I'm trying to figure out where the FDA is in this process, because there were public comments and now it's become kind of quiet. Like, when could consumers expect a new label?
It's a great question. So I can't speculate on the exact timeline, but I can tell you what the FDA has done and what they have indicated they plan to do next. So the FDA has already completed a review of research on nutrition labels and conducted some focus groups with consumers to test some early drafts of a potential label. They've also now indicated their next steps include conducting two additional studies to get more feedback on draft labels. That will include a survey of about 2,000 adults getting their reactions to different label designs. So asking questions like, how clear is this label to you? How relevant is it to you? They'll also do an experimental study. So they'll expose consumers to different types of labels to get their reactions to those labels. For example, seeing, do certain labels shift consumers towards healthier products more effectively than other labels? And they'll combine the results of those two studies to continue to develop their new healthy symbol. So that's where they are, sort of in the middle of the research process.
What about the food makers? How likely would companies start to use a voluntary healthy labeling system like this?
It's a good question. Prior studies of these voluntary programs indicate that companies will use the label. So I think there will be uptake. The exact extent to which consumers will see this on new products, you know, will it be 5% of products or 100% of products will bear this new label, I think will depend on the FDA's new definition of healthy. So what percent of the food supply will meet that new definition? But I do think companies are interested in using these labels because we know from the research that these healthy labels tend to encourage consumers to buy those products. So companies will have some incentive to want to display the label since it could help drive their sales.
You mentioned a couple words about their surveys that they want to find out clear and relevant, you know, when it comes to food labels. And that to me isn't what food labels, I mean, reading food labels is difficult. What mistakes do people make when they look at these labels?
Yeah, you bring up a good point. And I think one reason that the FDA is interested in developing this new label is exactly what you mentioned, that reading food labels can be quite difficult. And I think a key reason for that is that the main label we have right now that's mandated in the US is the Nutrition Facts Panel. And your listeners are probably all familiar with this label. It's shown on the back of product packaging. It has a lot of numbers, number of calories, percent of saturated fat. And that information is very important for consumers to have access to. And it can be difficult to integrate and understand. We often have to perform calculations to understand how to use it. By contrast, what the FDA is developing and what other countries have done is a more summary measure. So something that integrates that information on the Nutrition Facts Panel and helps interpret it for consumers in a way that's much quicker and easier for us to understand. And the label will also be on the front of the product packaging, so it will be better able to grab consumers' attention. You won't have to turn around the product to get that information. So I think that is addressing this concern with the difficulty of using that Nutrition Facts Panel is exactly why the FDA and why other countries have gravitated towards these front of package labels that do some work for consumers, that do some interpretation and provide some more clear guidance about which products are healthier and which products are less healthy.
I'm also aware that product packaging can get very busy, that there are other logos and stamps on packaged food. I'm thinking of like the heart check mark saying it's certified to meet the nutritional guidelines specified by the American Heart Association. Do you think more logos could make this more confusing for people?
It's a great question. And you're right that when we go to the store and look at products, we're bombarded with marketing, even when we're just looking at the product packaging, to say nothing about the store environment as a whole. I do think that the development of a standardized front of package label, like what the FDA is doing, could provide clarity to consumers, because it would be the same label across a large variety of products, as opposed to, you know, an American Heart Association label and a label from a different organization. So I think the federal government creating a label could be helpful to provide some uniformity in front of package labeling, though I agree that I expect that the front of product packaging will probably remain crowded for the reasons that you mentioned.
We're talking about food labeling and the future of it, what the FDA could decide, with Anna Grumman, who is a postdoctoral fellow in the Department of Nutrition at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. You can join in on food labels and whether you would want a stamp or a logo on a package that says healthy. What would that mean to you? What would impact your choices in the grocery store aisle? 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org on food labels. So you mentioned other countries, Anna, like, you know, I think it's Chile implementing health warning labels on food and beverages with high amounts of added sugar and sodium fat. How do other countries approach this type of labeling?
It's a great question. And the approach that other countries have taken is actually a little bit different than what the FDA is doing. So the FDA is developing what we would call a positive label. So it's meant to encourage consumers to buy a certain product or to shift their consumption towards healthier options. And their label would only be applied to healthier foods, right, that meet that nutrition standard the FDA will set. And less healthy foods will not be labeled at all. What other countries are doing, including Chile and a number of other Latin American countries, is the opposite. They're requiring warning labels that would be applied to products that are very high in sugar and sodium and saturated fat. So these are less healthy products because we're concerned about those nutrients. And these negative labels are meant to discourage consumption of those less healthy products. It's sort of the opposite of the FDA's approach. And healthier foods are not labeled in these countries. They don't get those warning labels. And we think from the research that these negative labels are potentially more effective than the positive labels because they grab attention better and evoke consumers' emotional responses more strongly. So it's interesting the FDA has gravitated towards the healthy labels. And I think it'd be very exciting for them to test those healthy labels directly against the systems that other countries are using and that we're seeing in the research is effective at informing consumers and driving healthier purchases.
I think that's so interesting because of that psychological effect that you explained going on when there is a warning about the product. And I wonder, too, about the implications of that type of approach on the bottom line of profits for that particular product. And whether that psychological effect of avoiding a product could be, avoidance means that there's people aren't buying it. Therefore, that product, either goes up in price or doesn't make as much money, maybe gets pulled off the shelf.
It's a great question. Yes. And you're nailing the interest that companies have in these positive labels, right? Companies tend to support those sorts of labeling programs more than the warning labels or the negative labels. Hmm. What we're seeing in countries like Chile that have already implemented these warnings is that the research suggests these warnings are not causing job loss, for example, or big changes in profits. Hmm. Instead, we're seeing that they actually create opportunities for new companies to enter the marketplace to support large food manufacturers in, for example, reformulating their products so that they wouldn't be required to display this warning, right? To remove some salt from the product so that the warning wouldn't be mandated. And that is, you know, good for industry. And it's also good for consumers because we're giving them healthier options sort of by default without having to even notice the label. So I think there's certainly a concern among companies and opportunities to improve the food supply in a way that's good for consumers and does not harm companies' bottom lines.
Let's bring in a caller now. Kevin joining us from Janesville. Kevin, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Hi, good morning. I'd like to see some sort of color-coded label, like green for low sodium, purple for low fat. I appreciate the heart healthy logo, keto friendly, all these abbreviations that we're already used to looking for on our labels, and then put them in like a big pie chart. And if it meets five out of the six, then it's also labeled as healthy, but it would be a really quick visual for consumers to just look at it and go, bing, bing, bing.
Kevin, thank you so much for that. Anna, what about color coding to help people make choices?
I think Kevin is absolutely right that it's so useful when these labels can leverage our automatic associations, right? So green for go or red for stop. And we see in the research that labels that leverage these automatic associations are quite effective at grabbing our attention and helping us very quickly and easily understand more about a product. So totally on board with a color-coded labeling system.
In our last 30 seconds together, what are you watching for here out of the FDA? What are the next steps?
I will be excited to see their final label design and see it compared to what some other countries are doing. And I think the bottom line for consumers is that when these food labels are designed well, they're likely to help us identify healthier products and make healthier choices.
Yes. And, you know, even how a logo is designed can have implications, I would imagine. So there's a lot going into that visual.
That's right. I think it's crucial for us to invest in research to get the details of this policy right so that these new labels can have the biggest possible benefits for consumers and for public health.
Anna, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Anna Grumman is a postdoctoral fellow in the Department of Nutrition at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, as we've been talking about food labels. Just ahead, we talk with a literacy coach about how to help children who struggle with reading. Has your child fallen behind on literacy? What will you do about it this summer? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.